Hey there, you're listening to 101.5 FM on UMFM. I'm your host, Ryan Funk, and welcome to U-Talk. Who else is excited for Jurassic World Dominion? Because I know I am. While we wait for summer, let's learn more about the science that first inspired Michael Crichton, paleontology. And to do that, we have the executive director from the Canadian Fossil Discovery Center and paleontologist, Dr. Femke Halwerda. Let's get into it. What was life like before? No matter how much we ponder, it will always be an alien reality to our own. Another world. There are some things that help. Fossils are one of them. A new announcement shed some light on the mysteries of Manitoba millions of years ago. Tucked away in the city of Morden, the Canadian Fossil Discovery Center has unveiled a nearly complete shark specimen.
Yeah, I am Adolfo Quetara. I am the executive director at the Canadian Fossil Discovery Center. The Fossil Discovery Center just hosts the biggest collection of marine reptiles in Canada. So we are located Morden, south of Manitoba, and just at the foot of the Manitoba Escarpment. And along all the Manitoba Escarpment, that is a ridge that is crossing Manitoba from southeast to northwest, is full of fossils from the Cretaceous period when Manitoba was under the sea. So it was a western interior seaway. It was a shallow sea that it was just crossing from the Hudson Bay until the Gulf of Mexico. So we are surrounded by fossils all around this area, and we were collecting for the last 50 years now.
I love the CFDC, and it's just something about Manitoba's history that you don't necessarily think about. Like, what? It was a seaway like 60-some million years ago? It's such a crazy thing to think about.
Yeah, exactly. So there are people... It's not aware that in history we are thinking just in hundreds of years, thousands of years, but long time before we were over here, they were all a very different way of life here, and we are just showing to the public this kind of life that it was existing before him. That today is Manitoba.
We're dipping our toes into learning more about some of the life in that Western Interior Seaway. So, an amazing announcement. What can you tell me about this this announcement?
This is a very, very special unveiling for the CFDC because this specimen that we are showing today to the public, it has to be discovered twice because it was discovered first in 1975, in mining operations, just very close, just a few miles west of Morden. But it was just in the collections room in a field jacket, together with other many, many field jackets from the 70s and 80s. And it was not until 2012 that the crew working in the back just decided to start open some few jackets, and they realized that in this jacket was something different. It was not a mosasaur, not a fish, not a bird, it was something other thing. So they opened and they realized it was a shark, a huge shark, and in very, very well preserved. The level of preservation is amazing. So different people was working on this fossil during a few years, and in 2014, we contacted a specialist in shark, fossil sharks, and they started to realize that it was something different. And now we are unveiling this fossil after a couple of years working directly on the fossil and on the exhibit. The scientific study, the research is still underway and it will be published in the future. Everything sounds like it's going to be a new species. And now we can say that is the only near complete shark skeleton in Canada, is the only filter feeder shark in the Western Interior Seaway, in the sediments in North America, and one of the three, four biggest fossil sharks complete cirques in the world. It's very special also because you know that the sharks, the skeletons of the sharks are made of cartilage. It's so difficult, it's very difficult, the preservation, because it's very soft material. So that's why we usually find only teeth. And many species, shark species, sting sharks, are defined by the shape of the teeth or the size, because it's the only thing that we are finding. In this case, we have a near complete shark with no teeth. So it's the opposite. So, and the reason is because it's a filter feeder shark. These sharks that they were like the whale shark, that they were just swimming, open mouth, filtering plankton, small creatures. So is everything is special about this specimen.
I just remember volunteering at the CFDC and, you know, seeing people work on it in the back room, and there's always speculation around how could the shark not have its teeth, because, you know, usually that's the only thing that you find, the teeth of a shark. And it's really, really cool to hear this announcement that it's a new species and a potential filter feeder. What does that announcement look like today? What is this exhibit going to look like?
Exhibit is pretty spectacular. It's big. We just commissioned a special reconstruction, in life reconstruction, a drawing to Julia Sottoni, a famous Canadian paleo artist, and is probably the best paleo artist in Canada. And he drew for us a very nice landscape where with the shark and all the creatures that they were living at that time. So this is a backlit print, huge, and with a poster and all the shark, that you can see the fossil through the glass in very, very close, just 1 foot from you, and you can appreciate all the details and all the level of preservation that the shark has.
This is a great announcement, a really cool finding, but it isn't the only cool thing that you can see at the CFDC. What are some other exhibits currently available that people can come and witness?
Our ambassador is everybody knows Bruce. Bruce is the biggest skeleton of a mosasaur in display in the world. We have the world record, the world Guinness record, and this is in exhibit, and you can see a reconstructed replica just hanging from the ceiling, in complete replica of the skeleton. But you can see just underneath in glass cabinets all the original bones that from this specimen. So you can see, you can compare the original bone with where it's located in the whole skeleton in the replica. It's just close by Susie. It's another mosasaur, smaller than this. And you can see also the original bones of Susie. So the mosasaur hall now with this addition of the shark is pretty spectacular. It's nothing like this in Canada, and just nothing like this in the whole world. So it's worth a visit.
Not only are you stepping back in time to witness what life was like before people could ever see it, it's a great way to support a community as well.
One of the assets of the Canadian Fossil Discovery Center is that it's a tourism attraction, right? So it's not just about science, about education. We are the best tourism attraction in this in the Pembina Valley. So we are working very closely with the municipality and with the province in this side of this fossil museum, is that it's a huge tourism asset. We are bringing an economic value for the community, and it's going to be bigger in the future, because we have plenty of projects for the future also.
I mean, it might be too early to ask, but, you know, what are some of I know there's a lot of different events and projects and different initiatives that the CFDC takes part in throughout the spring and summer seasons. Is there anything that you can share for people who are going to be coming down maybe to visit as restrictions continue to ease?
Something that we were offering, our program, STAR program, was the dig tours. So we used to to bring people to the field, and they can just feel what is like digging for fossils and finding fossils in our dig sites. So we can sell this program during the last 2 years for the pandemic. But now we want to retake this, but in a very special way, because we are working now to build a field station in our property. We own 100 acres in the Skarmen. So we want to build a nice field station there where we can bring the people for a dig site, but we can offer also a place where they can see how the fossils are clean and preserved, and they can have a space for to take the lunch, and they will have washrooms, and so we will have some infrastructure there, and we will offer again the dig tools in a better way than before. So we are very excited with this project because it's going to be the biggest project that we are in 50 years. It will be our biggest asset and our biggest program and biggest investment. So hopefully this will be hopefully finished by August, September. This year is going to be a little bit like a test, but for sure next year is going to be great for the CFDC.
I know a cool thing that the CFDC offers is the audio tours, and they're especially useful for individuals where English isn't necessarily their first language, because there's a variety of languages that it's offered in.
We are offering right now in English, French, and in Cree language. In the past, we were offering in more languages, but now we are working in offering also in Spanish. But yes, at least those three languages are available right now.
When you're walking around as executive director at the CFDC and just looking at things, of course, the new shark is a standout. But what sort of fossil or exhibit that is just your favorite when you're touring for yourself?
That's a difficult question because everything is pretty amazing. But I feel some special curiosity about, for example, in our property, in our dig sites, we used to find a huge concentration of Hesperornis. Hesperornis was a flightless bird. It was like a penguin with teeth, but with no capacity to fly. So was spending most of his life in the sea. But we are finding a lot of Hesperornis fossils. That means that we probably, this site was located close to the shore of the sea, this interior seaway. But the funny thing is that we are finding mostly legs, but only right legs. It's very difficult to find a left leg of the fossil. So we have a lot of right femurs, right tibias, but almost no left ones. So that has to be an explanation. It's something that is just, you know, running my mind all the time because it's very weird. That's funny. One of the incredible fossils that we have, we discovered lately in the lab, our lab technician, Jerry Peters, was working in microfossils. So he was looking for extremely small fossils surrounding the sediments in the field jackets, surrounding the big fossils, that is shale. So he was passing by the MIA microscope all these sediments, and he found a very special thing, that is the smallest mosasaur vertebra in the world. So we have the biggest mosasaur vertebra in the world. This is one from Bruce. And we have the smaller one. It's 3 millimeters in diameter, only 3 millimeters size. And it's impossible to see what it is if you can't put it under the microscope. So now we can say that we have the biggest mosasaur vertebra, and the smaller mosasaur vertebra was pretty neat for us also.
Coming back to the community aspect of the CFDC, what does this, you know, announcement of the shark fossil mean for the community of Morden?
We are working constantly improving the visitor experience. So it's our goal, right? So it's not only about coming and just reading posters or watching glass cabinets, we want to improve and the visitor experience and the curiosity of the people. And that's why we are bringing more people every time. Every year we are growing in visitation. Even with the pandemic, even when we were closed for 10 months in 2 years, but even though when we were open, we feel that we are growing in visitation. So people are looking for different experiences, and they are discovering that here they can see something that they can't see anywhere else. So it's very special. We are working for a new facility for the future. So all those new SCBs that we are working on now are just, we are thinking in the new facility already. So those new SCBs is like an advance of that what we will be doing in the new facility in the future. So that's very exciting, and we will have more and more. Every year we will have new exhibits and new fascinating things.
If someone's coming to look at this new fossil at the CFDC, what sort of rules or regulations are still in place when people are just coming to visit?
We are constantly following the health authorities in Manitoba, the health authorities' advice. So we starting on the March 1st this month, we are not asking for the fully vaccination proof anymore. And starting just 3 days ago, in March 15, we are not just requiring the mask. So this is what the province is telling us. So now the masks are recommended, but not obligatory. So anyone can come right now with any kind of restriction, it used to be before the pandemic.
And where can people go to find out more about the CFDC?
Well, they can visit our websites. It's www.discoverfossils.com. And even in the website, in the top right, they can discover like Safe at Home collections management system. So they can click there and they will open a new website with our collection. So we are just uploading there all the information we have about our collections. At the end, when we finish this year, they will be able to see 1,500 specimens with more than 20,000 fossils. And probably around 50,000 photos. So all the information we have in the museum will be available publicly for everyone.
There have been 1.2 million species that have been described on this planet, and an untold number that once lived here. It's up to dedicated scientists and students who spend their careers seeking to learn more about life millions of years ago. Dr. Femke Halwarda is one such scientist. As the Dr. Elizabeth Nichols Postdoctoral Fellow at the Royal Tyrrell Museum, she studies the diet of mosasaurs from the Bear Paw Formation in southern Alberta.
Sure, well, thank you for having me, first of all. So I am now a postdoc in paleontology. I am the Dr. Betsy Nichols Postdoctoral Research Fellow here at the Royal Tyrrell. And it's been a bit of a journey for me to get to here. I always wanted to be a paleontologist ever since I was 3 years old. So after high school, I went to university, like more or less everybody will do. I picked biology at the advice of a Dutch paleontologist at Naturalis Biodiversity Center. And he said, yeah, either you want to study the rocks or you want to study the animals. And he said, if you want to study the animals, biology is a better way of getting into paleo. And I thought, yeah, I'm more interested in the living animals, or you know, studying dinosaurs as if they were living animals than just the rocks they're from. So back then in the Netherlands, there wasn't really a paleontology master's. And there were a couple of programs around Europe, but I didn't really know that much about them. So I decided to stay in the Netherlands and do my master's there as well. So I did biogeology, which is kind of, it approaches paleontology, but it's still not the perfect, you know. And I think nowadays they have a master's, so I just missed out like a couple of years after my time. Yeah, they started a master's program now. So, and then I kind of drifted for a couple of years because it was hard to find a PhD position. I mean, it still is. It's like you have to really land either a grant or somebody who has a grant or who has just, you know, research money. So I actually worked in a geochemical lab for a year as a research assistant, working on stable isotopes on rock layers. That was pretty cool. I think that gave me a good sort of geochemical background, which I still use in my research now. So that was good. Then I worked for a year as sort of semi-preparator, semi-researcher on a dinosaur egg project in Portugal, which is really cool. Yeah. And actually, that was supposed to be for 2 years, but after 1 year, I got my much desired PhD position. So then I went to Germany to do my PhD on sauropod dinosaurs, long-necked dinosaurs. And then, after that, I had basically a short postdoc project in Germany, and then I landed this one. So that's kind of, been all over the place.
Well, that's super cool. And at the beginning, you mentioned Dr. Betsy Nichols, correct?
Yes.
Oh, that's so cool, because she holds so much significance at the Canadian Fossil Discovery Center, where I have a lot of experience with. So that's awesome. That's super cool, just to, you know, the world feeling even smaller once again.
Yeah, she was a powerhouse. I really wish I could have met her, but it's nice that, we have this postdoc named after her, and yeah, so we carry on her legacy, hopefully.
Yeah, and it's, just the impact that she had in paleontology is so amazing. And it seems like just women in general have had such a significant impact on this study, though, you know, many don't get the recognition they deserve. Because, I can't remember her name right now. The lady who discovered the ichthyosaur out in Britain.
Mary Anning.
Yeah, that's it.
Historical figure, yeah.
So cool.
Yeah, there's a really great kids book about her now as well that I was thinking of getting for my kids who will be born in September. So that's like a nice sort of example of you know, women in STEM, women in paleontology.
Yeah, it's awesome. Yeah, it's been a boys' club for so long. Like, just, it's great to see, you know, these women who are integral to this study, you know, finally getting this recognition. I think there was also a movie about her. I think it's called Ammonite. I can never say that right.
Ammonite. Yeah, I haven't seen it yet, actually. But I heard it was good. Yeah.
Getting back on topic, for those who are unaware, you know, we've talked a lot about like dinosaurs and fossils, but what exactly is paleontology?
Right. So paleontology, sort of, if you break it down, it's ancient Greek for the study of ancient beings. So I think that that's a good distinction already from archaeology, which is kind of like the study of the ancient people. So basically, paleontology studies past life on Earth, and it could go into deep time. It doesn't necessarily have to, but usually it is kind of like, yeah, you're talking about past life of like several million years ago, up to all the way to the beginning of life on Earth. And then, of course, vertebrate paleontology distinguishes itself by studying only vertebrates, so everything with the spine, so that's kind of like everything from fish and over all the way up to dinosaurs and mammals.
I think just for myself, paleontology is just so cool to think about life before us. Just when you see these bones, just in your imagination, what would they have been like in real life? That's just always... But I'd love to see like a real animal like from back then. It gets me so excited to just think about.
Yeah, it's such a shame that we can't really transport ourselves in a time machine to like a little Jurassic ecosystem or something, or like a Cretaceous sea.
Because like you see the paleo art and all that, but it just never does it justice. Like, you know, you can see elephants out in Africa, but you know, being able to see a sauropod would just, it'd be mind-blowing.
Oh man, yeah, I hear that ground shake as they kind of walk by. Yeah, or, well, I always kind of say, like, you wouldn't want to snorkel with a mosasaur, I guess, but maybe on like a boat where you can see the seafloor through, you know, and then go on sort of a mosasaur cruise. That'd be cool.
Just an aspect that unfortunately we'll never be able to experience, but we can learn a little bit about them from their fossils left behind. So what about, you tell us about that. What exactly is a fossil and why do we study them?
So fossils are basically the remains of these past animals that we just talked about. And there's different categories of fossils, but I think most people will know bones as fossils. So that's basically the bones of these old animals that have turned to stone over the course of millions of years. There's a specific mineralization process. I won't go into the details because that gets tedious. But yeah, basically they take home messages. They turn into stone. They fossilize. So next to bones, you will have actually other bits of evidence they left of their life on Earth, which is footprints, for instance. Footprints can remain preserved, especially if they walked into wet mud. And then there's also other imprints, like imprints from feathers or skin. And if you're really lucky, you might find a little bit of soft tissue preserved, but that's very rare. We do have a beautiful little mosasaur here in our collections that has some stomach content preserved and a little bit of skin. That's really cool, but that's really rare. The reason why it's rare is because, you know, an animal died millions and millions of years ago and then got exposed to everything, the weather, the different climates, different landscapes even. And then, yeah, so you're actually really lucky if you find something nice. Usually you just find kind of bits and pieces that are left, and then it's up to us to puzzle those back together. But we study them because they are the only thing that will give us information about these past animals on Earth.
I think another interesting part about paleontology and learning about the animals' past lives, I can't remember, what is it, carbolites? The fossilized dung?
Oh, coprolites, yes.
Coprolite, there you go, thank you. I was like, I think I remember the word? Can't quite, but I think recently they discovered like a new beetle species from one. So like that's another aspect. Super cool.
No, that is a fun one to kind of study their fossilized poop, basically. Yeah, and then that can sometimes also say something about the species diversity. If you find different types of poop, it's like, oh, it's different types of animals lived here. Even though maybe their bones won't be found, you can find there.
Yeah. You can find something, yeah.
Yeah.
It's super cool. And on the topic of soft tissue, I know in kind of recent years there's been a lot of, not a lot, but like a few examples of creatures with soft tissue. Like there's a mummified hadrosaur, or like that's what people are calling it, which is super cool. I can't remember exactly where it's on display, or at least in study.
Oh, it is here in Canada, isn't it? Yeah, with the skin really nicely preserved.
And there was like a foot and had like a fingernail on a different one.
Oh.
There's a lot of cool things. And I think that one of the coolest examples is the nodosaur at the Royal Tyrrell Museum, which I got to see. And it is so cool. Like, it's so well preserved.
It's really well preserved. I mean, it was a preparator's nightmare. It almost took 10 years to prepare, but it's so worth it because it's so beautifully preserved. And you can see everything in detail. And I think recently they had some stomach contents also from it analyzed. And so you can see what it ate. And that's like, you win the jackpot if you find something like that.
How about you go into a little bit detail there? Like, it's not just going into the field and finding these remnants of creatures long past, but there is a lot of manual labor that goes into paleontology.
Absolutely. It's a whole process. Yeah, it's nice that you ask, because I think a lot of people don't realize that you find the fossil in the field and then you go on the cool field work, you take it home with you, you take it to the collections, and then the real work starts. Then the preparators will have to, you know, painstakingly get it out of the rock it's embedded in, with with little pneumatic drills, with little dentist tools if it needs to be really fine work. So I don't have the patience for it. I'm really glad that we have really good preparators who are really skilled and who have this patience, who will work on this for months in a row or sometimes even years. And that gets the best results. And then you have the animal or the specimen ready for study. So then the real research starts, and that takes a while as well, describing it first and taking the pictures and seeing what it's related to and analyzing stuff. So from basically finding something in the field to the, let's say, the end product that can either go in the exhibition or it's just nice enough to study, that sometimes takes several years before that's done.
It's a very involved job.
Absolutely. And you need to have a long breath for it, right? You need to just be patient and see it happening. For instance, just now a Mosasaur skull is getting prepped for my research, and it's really cool, but it will take some time. So I love going down to the lab and see it happening, and then more and more bones are starting to appear, and it's really exciting, but it will take some time.
I remember when I volunteered at the CFDC out in Morden, working on some of the material. I think out here in Manitoba we get a lot, I think the mineral's called gypsum, it's that clear crystal mineral, and it is such a pain to get off of the fossils.
That's bad
here.
News if you have to.
We get a lot of that on the fossils out here, or it's almost like a puzzle sometimes, because you got to super glue some of the materials back together because it just falls apart.
Oh man, yeah. If you have we have these nodules, for instance, which are just bits of hard rock, and then a bone is embedded in there, and they are in pieces. So first you have to puzzle those back together and then prep it out. And I think I almost got anxiety about it. I was I'm so glad I don't have to do this, because I wouldn't even know where to begin. But these people are just so skilled. They get it done. Yeah. And it becomes beautiful.
So looking back on your research, you studied sauropods from back in the Jurassic and some eggs. What brought you to mosasaurs? And we can talk a little bit more about what those are exactly afterwards.
Yeah, sure. So I'm from the Netherlands, and the very first mosasaur is actually from the Netherlands, at least the first historical mosasaur found to humankind. There was a skull found in the south of the Netherlands, and it's actually now still on display in Paris in the Natural History Museum. But so if you're from the Netherlands, that's kind of, if you're into paleontology, that's the only kind of Mesozoic fossil we have. There's another site which has a little bit of Triassic in the east. That's about it. So if you're into paleontology and you're a Dutch kid, you cannot go around mosasaurs. Basically, you will get into mosasaurs. and I did a little project. This was actually between when I was kind of hunting for PhD jobs. Me and Anna Schulp, who's a Dutch paleontologist, did a little project on mosasaur teeth from this, it's called Maastricht. It's actually the end stage of the Cretaceous, is named after this town. So it's these Maastrichtian mosasaurs. And so that got me into mosasaur research, really. And then I decided to expand that for my job application for this current job. So I was they have great mosasaur specimens at the Terraal. I know a little bit about mosasaur research and I do mosasaur teeth. So I went on to doing that.
We talked about dinosaurs a little bit, and now we're talking about mosasaurs. What's the difference between them?
Oh, yeah, well, whole score. So that's good also, because people always say, mosasaurs are dinosaurs, but mosasaurs are not dinosaurs. Mosasaurs are actually more closely related to lizards and snakes than they are to dinosaurs. So they're basically a type of varanid lizards with flippers. That's what I call them, and a tail. And they were completely marine. They lived in the late Cretaceous when the sea was nice and warm and tropical. So it was a good time to be a reptile in the sea. And they were probably the top predators in all of the ecosystems they inhabited. They became very successful as well. You can find them everywhere around the world. Some even in freshwater, but mostly in just marine settings. And it would have been a bad day if you were the prey of a mosasaur, because they had these really powerful skulls and lots of teeth. They even had teeth on their palate, like some snakes and some lizards have that as well, which is, you know, it's very cool, but it's also ultra scary if you're a prey. It's kind of to get the prey more into their mouth. And dinosaurs were more, are this specific group of reptiles that lived on land. So they're only related very way back, you know, to a common ancestor, way, way, way before the Mesozoic era.
I think mosasaurs are just so cool. Basically lizard whales.
Yeah. And they were completely marine as well. So they probably never came on land. So we don't know exactly how they reproduced, for instance, but there's speculation that they might have done live birth, just like what whales and dolphins do in the sea. And they were just really successful with their big bodies. You know, they got up to 12, 15 meters of length, which is insane. I mean, they're not as big as the ones you see in Jurassic World, because that one is just blown out of proportion. Someone's way too
big. media's involvement in paleontology and dinosaurs may skew people's opinions a little bit about what they are.
Yeah.
I think one of the biggest one is when I learned that velociraptors weren't as big as the ones in the movie. And most the consensus is they were completely feathered.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, those kind of things. And also, I think the brachiosaurus, they made them way too big, and the T-Rex is probably not as fast as as we see him. I mean, it's the films are great, but it's like
But at least dinosaurs getting some representation, right?
Right.
Like, at least there's some. I wish was more. But what can you do? What can you do? So I guess one of the big questions is mosasaurs. They're these massive marine apex predators living in the oceans. Why are we finding bones of them like here in Manitoba or out in Alberta?
All right. Yes, that's because back in the Cretaceous, about 75 million years ago, a huge part of North America was covered by a big inland sea called the Western Interior Seaway. I do not have a picture of it here, but it basically split the whole continent in half. So you had two big land masses, and in between this large sea, which would have been a little shallower towards the shore, where, you know, lots of fish would live. So that was ideal mosasaur feeding and hunting grounds, and, you know, nice warm water, because it was a greenhouse world in that time. So there was no sea ice, no ice on either the North or the South Pole. So nice and warm, good for, you know, being a reptile, nice and tropical, lots of food. And so you find a lot of mosasaurs from this sea all the way from the south, like I think Louisiana, Alabama, all the way up to us here in Canada.
So a very different world, not just with these creatures, but just the geology of it as well was completely different.
Yeah, true. And I think you can imagine if the ice is all melted, then you have a much higher sea level. So a lot of land in the Cretaceous was covered with shallow seas. It's like if we grab a map of the world, you have this big interior seaway in North America. You have big parts of South America also having the sea covering them. I think North Africa is also just half gone. Europe is definitely gone. Not on the map, just some islands. Yeah. So actually a really good time to be alive, to be a marine reptile.
Yep. Yeah. And there was like, when we're talking about the diversity of them, I think it's called the Charisiodon puntlogensis. I think I remember that name, that was found out in, BC. We got an exhibit of that at the CFDC. Another one, the Tylosaurus pembinensis, we got Bruce, which I think is the Guinness World Record holder's the largest publicly displayed mosasaur.
And
out in Miami, Manitoba, we have the holotype of the Tylosaurus pembinensis that was described by Betsy Nichols.
Cool. I'm really jealous of you having a nice Tylosaur, because we don't really have that many Tylosaurs here in the collections. Yeah, but you get the nice one.
Yeah, we got some really nice fossils up here. I think we have a lot of like plesiosaurs and elasmosaurs, but a ton of mosasaurs, specifically these Tylosaurus ones. And Bruce is so big. Like, being next to him, you're like, whoa, this is a monster.
Like, again, don't snorkel with them. Like, just
don't
take the cruise.
Don't snorkel. But it's just so cool. Like, paleontology just shows us a world that doesn't exist anymore. And we're talking about just a really small portion of, you know, life in general.
Absolutely, yeah. They got so big, it's insane. They were really just, they outcompeted more or less everybody else for marine dominance, except, you had some plesiosaurs and some sharks. And I think that those were like the other big marine creatures around them. And then there was just these mosasaurs everywhere. Yeah.
What other kind of research are you kind of doing right now? Is it just kind of focusing on the teeth aspect, and what does that research look like?
I mainly do this research on mosasaur teeth. So you might wonder, okay, you've got these awesome, really big mosasaurs. Why specifically focus on just the little teeth? But that's because teeth are very abundant in the fossil record as well. And also, when you don't have bones, sometimes, as I explained before, they don't always get preserved. Teeth actually preserve a little better because they're so hard. You know, like, we've got hard teeth as well. You can imagine that will preserve a lot better than bones. And then teeth can say a lot about an animal's diet. So I use these teeth, both their morphology, so the way they look, and also the micro scratches, the micro damage on teeth from different diets, and some geochemistry, which is kind of still because of my time in the lab, way, way, way back when, to reconstruct mosasaur diets here and to see if they coexisted next to each other, because you have all these different types of mosasaurs, or if, you know, there would be some overlap in ecological feeding niche, we'd say. So basically their feeding corner of the food chain. So I'm trying to figure that out. So that's really cool. And then of course I did my PhD on something completely different, on these long-necked dinosaurs, which I still kind of do in the background every now and again. So yeah, I did dinosaurs and now I do mosasaurs. But yeah, so I don't do both at the same time, because then you get confused, because you have your marine animals and your land animals. But so with these long-necked dinosaurs, I mainly do the early evolution of these guys in the early middle Jurassic. So that's about 170 million years ago. Whereas these mosasaurs, they're like more like 75 million years old. So that's about 100 million years difference between the two.
Yeah. And I mean, it doesn't get boring. You're learning about two completely different kind of like groups of creatures.
Right. Everything is interesting. Yeah. I mean, you have to at some point specialize into something. But I think everything invertebrate paleontology, especially in the Mesozoic, for me is very interesting.
Coming back to just paleontology as a whole and kind of working in STEM, you know, we've talked a little bit about Mary Anning and, you know, how for years her contributions to science were just not recognized. Have you faced any challenges as a woman working in STEM and someone, you know, from the Netherlands coming here? Have you faced any challenges, or has, you know, the environment kind of become more welcoming?
I think it's getting better and better for women in science and women in paleontology. There's definitely still challenges to be had. I think if you look at the numbers of you know, students who will enroll in a bachelor's or master's course, everything is still quite evenly distributed in terms of gender. Mm-hmm. And then if you look at PhD numbers, and especially postdoc numbers, so basically after first getting the specialization into a doctor's degree, and then in the postdoctoral phase, you see this massive, we call it the leaking pipe, you see this decrease in women, basically, who just leave the field, because they either feel they're not supported, or they will have families, and that is not supported by the system. Mm-hmm. So there's definitely a lot of work to do still, but I think it's getting better and better. For myself, I've been feeling very welcome here in Canada. It was relatively easy to get a work permit, and if you really get home here in the Tyrol, and everybody's been really supportive. So of me as a woman in paleo, so that's great. I still do a lot of work. I run the Women in Paleo group for the European Association of Vertebrate Paleontology, which is now all happening online, of course, because we're all still in a pandemic. And I think it is important for women to kind of help the younger generation in, but it's also definitely, of course, the established people who are, you know, the great majority of which are men. I think they have a lot to gain with supporting the younger generation getting into paleontology. So yeah, it's you know, there's still a lot of pitfalls, but I think it's definitely better than, let's say, 10, 20 years ago. Having said that, I think the pandemic kind of messed things up a bit for women in science. There was a paper out recently, I think, on a study where it showed that because women still get the majority of caring tasks, mm-hmm. either paid or unpaid, a lot of women during the pandemic, because of the lockdown, actually lost out on a lot of opportunities to publish and to do research. And you can now see that there's this big discrepancy between male and female scientists' output. So mm-hmm. I hope that will recover, you know, after mm-hmm. now that it's, I think it's kind of like, yeah, it's 50-50 whether or not we're recovering from the pandemic, or if it's going to last a bit longer. I think it's looking good so far, fingers crossed that the world's opening up again. But yeah, that's definitely an issue, I think. And I hope, yeah, that, you know, that won't last, that sort of backlog. Yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely a kind of a conversation just about societal norms, like you mentioned, females taking on more of those caring roles that, you know, in terms of like familial units, maybe the distribution of like caring time needs to be equalized. And just I think just seeing women in kind of leadership roles in terms of like science is great for getting like young girls inspired to join science. Because yeah, for a long period of time, like you just see, when you picture scientists, when you close your eyes, it's usually just a white guy in a lab coat.
Right.
So definitely diversity is greatly needed, and I think just opens up new aspects for ideas and, you know, what people want to study. Because, you know, paleontology, yeah, there's so much.
And I think it's exactly what you say. It's like the more you normalize all these different types of people who are scientists, and as you say, not just the dude in the lab coat. The more you normalize that, the easier it gets, and the more you combat these stereotypes that kind of persist. And that forced people into certain roles over periods of time. I think, that's really important, to get everybody out there.
So what advice would you give someone who's maybe listening to this conversation and has been inspired to learn more about paleontology, or maybe they want to study paleontology themselves? Maybe they're heading into university and they're like, oh, this sounds like something cool. Or someone overseas that wants to come study here in Canada, because we have tons of amazing specimens and different species that can be found here.
Yeah, so, I always tell people, just go for it, right? It might not be the field where you earn the most money with, but then I guess if you want to earn lots of money, you have to maybe just become a lawyer or something. but if it's your passion, if you're excited and enthusiastic, then definitely go for it. There won't always be a job immediately for you, but if you persist, look at my background, I kind of went all over the place, but it worked out in the end, and I could use all those skills that I acquired in the end as well. So just go for it. Probably connect with your local museum is a really good way of starting. For instance, the Terrell, and I guess your museum as well, will have lots of programs for young people and kids to engage them into science. So that's usually a really good place to start. If you want to come to Canada, my experience has been really positive coming to Canada. It's really crazy, because I started my postdoc literally a couple of weeks before the whole world shut down. And I didn't know it at the time. I was kind of naively thinking, it's going to be fine. So we flew in to Canada, and I think 2 weeks later, everything shut down and all the airports closed. So it's been doubly nice, because I felt really safe here during the pandemic. Which was crazy. But I think, we've got a lot of great collections, and I think everything works, right? Like the local people who study the fossils will add to the research, as well as international people. And I think paleontology is a very international field. I think, especially the newer generation of scientists, are all about cooperation between different institutions, which is really nice, because that only makes research better. My advice would be, go for it, connect to your local museum and your local specialists who can help you with their network, probably. And go to start small with the smaller conferences. If you feel confident, you can go and talk to people. Maybe don't immediately go to the really big ones if you don't know anybody, that can be intimidating. but usually get somebody to help you a little bit, to mentor you a little bit.
Awesome. And finally, you've studied both sauropods and now mosasaurs. If you could research anything in terms of paleontology, what would you want to research?
That's a good question. So I think when I started, I really wanted to study theropods, like big theropods, like Tyrannosaurus, like Gigantosaurus, I think, who's now going to be making an appearance in the latest Jurassic World franchise, from what I saw. I actually am studying a little bit on isotopes on teeth of Spinosaurus, which, yeah, and that's it's been in the news quite a bit recently.
Controversial or otherwise?
So I kind of got to do those. It's a wild ride sometimes with the, when an animal becomes a popular studied dinosaur, everybody will suddenly study them. But so I got to do that a little bit, so that's cool. Another thing I really want to do is pterosaurs. I think they're pretty cool.
Pterosaurs are awesome.
They're so weird though. Their anatomy is really, really weird. But yeah, that makes it really interesting. I think, yeah, that's the nice thing is, you know, if you connect with a lot of people, you get different research ideas and then you start to end up in more, you know, in a variety of projects. So yeah, that's another nice thing about paleontology, I guess.
I'm Ryan Funk. This was U Talk, and have yourself a good one.